It has been a pleasure to be in your community this weekend and to have been able to share this series of lessons. As we close today, I want you to turn, if you will, to 1 Corinthians chapter 12. In 1 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul's going to discuss a phenomenon or a situation that I call corporate individuality. Now, corporate individuality is probably a word I made up, and it's probably an oxymoron, kind of like jumbo shrimp and Kentucky football. We covered that last night. There's some things that just don't go together. As Paul is talking to this group of people, he's going to discuss with them the concept that they are part of an organism, not a part of an organization. And Paul never describes the church as an organization. He always describes it as an organism. Now, as we get into this discussion, the background is kind of important. The city of Corinth had 250,000 people in it, about the size of the city of Huntsville, maybe a little bit larger than the city of Springfield. There were 400,000 slaves in the city of Corinth. So you've got a free population and a slave population. You also have, because Corinth is on this isthmus, it's a trade route, and you've got a great influx of multicultural people. Particularly in the church, you had people from a Jewish background, and then you had people from a non-Jewish background. That could have been anybody. That could have been Roman, barbarian, Scythian. It could have been all kinds of, but you basically have the distinction between Jewish and non-Jewish. The gospel comes to Corinth, and people obey the gospel. And then on Sunday morning, you've got slaves and free people worshiping together. You could have had the situation in the city of Corinth where you've got an owner and the owned serving on the Lord's table. You extrapolate that out in about 10 years, and slavery in the city of Corinth and in the Greek first century was very similar to just a job. It was almost like being a butler or a house servant in some cases. And so a slave could be married. A slave could have a family. Sometimes they lived there on the property. Sometimes they didn't. But, you know, you've got a slave who became a Christian. His wife became a Christian. And his children grew to be faithful Christians. He's qualified to be an elder. So now you're worshiping with your slave who is your elder. You think there's some submission dynamics going on there? You've got that background. Then you've got this group of people. You've got the Jewish people who come out of the history of the 1,000 years or plus of dealing with the law of Moses. The Jewish people had a very strict food code. And even the New Testament Christians sometimes felt locked into that cultural idea. You know, for the most part, if you understand the Levitical food laws, God wouldn't let them eat anything that was a predator or a scavenger. That's pretty much the way the distinction is made between the cloven hooves and the animal who chewed the cud. Probably the only exception to that was in the water. They could eat animals that were predators, because in the water, if you had fins and scales, you could eat it. But the animals that you can eat in the water usually swallow their food whole. They don't rend or tear the flesh. And for whatever reason, that was the prohibition. He didn't want anything that was a scavenger. He didn't want to eat anything that ate dead. And he didn't want anything that tore the flesh or rended the flesh. So a Jewish person couldn't eat catfish. They couldn't eat lobster. They couldn't eat shrimp. They couldn't eat a lot of the land animals, because they do tend to either predate or scavenge. And so the Jews couldn't do that. Now, the interesting thing about that is that when a Jewish person considered something unclean, it wasn't like when we have things that we can't eat. I'm on a semi-restrictive diet. I shouldn't eat a lot of bread products. I don't really have a gluten sensitivity as much as something about the wheat products don't make me feel real good. I've had some work done under the hood there because of some intestinal issues. And so I'm not supposed to eat certain things. I've never looked at a Krispy Kreme donut and thought, man, that's nasty. The things that I'm supposed to eat, I wished I could eat. The things I can't have, man, I look at those things and think, if I could have that, if I could have a Krispy Kreme donut right now, I'd take a pat of butter, put it on that Krispy Kreme donut. I'd heat it up in the microwave. I'd take a Wendy's Frosty and drop it in the middle of that hole. And I'd drizzle honey over the top of it. And I'd eat it with a spoon while you watched. But when I see the things that I can't, I don't go, man, that's bad. A Jewish person saw something that was unclean and it was like, oh. To them, it looked like roadkill armadillo. They couldn't have. The Gentiles didn't have any issues with that. They ate lots of weird stuff. They ate stuff with blood in it. They actually consumed blood straight. And so, can you imagine potluck Sunday in Corinth? You've got a table that folks won't even walk by, and you've got a table over here that folks say, that's just weird. And these people are trying to get along in the church. God told Moses, he said, when you build an altar to me, you don't build an altar with steps. You either approach it on flat ground or you build a ramp, lest the nakedness of your priest become uncovered. And I think God was protecting people from themselves. If I'm in the assembly and the priest starts walking up the steps and he trips, I'm going to laugh. Probably get zapped, but I can't help myself. You know how things are funnier in church when they shouldn't be? Okay, so, you know, but the Jewish people took that concept of not uncovering the nakedness of your priest, and they were hyper modest. Their men wore undergarments and long robes, and they covered their ladies from their feet to the top of their heads, and they wore veils, and very, very sensitive to their modesty. And Gentiles didn't have those kind of hang-ups. In the city of Corinth, you have the beginning of the Olympian Games, or a precursor to the Olympian Games, called the Isthmus Games. And when they competed in those contests, they competed in those contests in the nude. The Greek word gymnos means naked. We get our word gymnasium from that. And when these guys came and did these athletic events, you know, you think Under Armour makes you uncomfortable when somebody goes jogging? No, you'd pay good money for a pair of Under Armour around the Corinthian guys because they didn't wear anything. Now, being a little tongue-in-cheek, you know, think about that guy making announcements on Sunday. Okay, the youth group is going to meet on Saturday to play flag football. No. The Jewish kids won't play on Saturday. But the youth group is going to meet Monday to play flag football. Remember, no shorts. The Jewish kids go, no shorts, we'll wear our robes. The Gentile kids go, no problem. And then they show up to play ball, and it's this mess. Can you imagine those diverse groups of people trying to worship together and what their unity problems and what their functionality problems would be? So as Paul talks to this group about how you get along as a group, he's going to do two things. Well, he'd do more than that. He's going to talk about many but one. He's going to talk about different but same. And then he's going to describe three scenarios that should never take place in a body. In fact, he's going to talk about three ridiculous scenarios that should never take place in the body. So as we read this, look, if you will, and just every time you see the concept of different but same, let a bell go off in your head. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 4. There are diversities, fancy word for different. There are diversities of gifts, but the same Spirit. There are differences in ministries, but the same Lord. There are diversities of activities, but it is the same God who works all in all. Now, the manifestation of the Spirit is given to each one for the profit of all. Now, notice he's going to talk about specific different manifestations. For to one is given the word of wisdom through the Spirit, to another the word of knowledge through the same Spirit, to another faith by the same Spirit, to another the gifts of healings by the same Spirit, to another the working of miracles, to another prophecy, to another discerning of spirits, to another different kinds of tongues, to another interpretation of tongues, but one and the same Spirit works in all these things, distributing to each one individually as He wills. So He talks about their different roles, same Spirit. Different jobs, same Spirit. Different, same, different, same, different, same. And then He's going to immediately switch and talk about many but one, or one but many. For as the body is one, but has many members, but all the members of that one body being many are one body, so also is Christ. So He goes from we're different, but we're the same, to there's a lot of us and there's one body, but there's many of us. For by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body. One of those fun things about biblical interpretation is you should never let an obscure or unclear verse shed clarity or meaning on an absolute crystal clear verse. Folks, this is your verse for baptism. How does a person get to be in the body? They're baptized. The body's the church. The church is the body. You can't be in the body without baptism. You can't be in the church without baptism. Is baptism essential for salvation? That's one of those duh moments. Okay, that's one of those rock solid, crystal clear things. For by one Spirit we're all baptized into one body, whether... And that's not a word I use a lot in my vocabulary. If I translate this into the Alabama English version of the Bible, that would be, it don't matter. So we'll read it in Alabama English. For by one Spirit we're all baptized into one body, and it don't matter if you're a Jew or a Greek. It don't matter if you're a slave or a free. We have all been made to drink into one Spirit. For in fact, the body is not one member but many. See, when we introduced our lesson, we talked about slaves and free and Jew and Greek, and Paul says you're all part of the same congregation. You're all part of the same body. And it doesn't matter what your background is. He'll go on to say in other places, it doesn't matter if you're male or female, it doesn't matter if you're young or old. It doesn't matter what your status is, you have an ownership, you have a membership, you have a participation in the body. And we're different, but it's the same body. We have different roles that came from the same Spirit. We have different backgrounds, but we're baptized in the same way, into the same Lord, into the same water for the same reason. And there's lots of us, but it's one body, and there's one body, and there's lots of us. And then he starts talking about the three things that should never, ever happen in a body, because if they did, the body would be either A, dysfunctional, or B, ridiculous. Verse 14 again, for in fact, the body is not one member, but many. If the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I'm not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the ear should say, because I'm not of an eye, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? The first ridiculous situation is, what if one of your body parts took the day off? What if one of your body parts quit working? You ever slept on your hand and it go to sleep? And then your cell phone ring and you try to do that touch screen with that dead hand? You ever sat with your leg crossed? And then somebody say, as we stand and sing, and you know, that foot's asleep? What happens when your body checks out on you? If one of your body members doesn't work, the rest of the body is affected. The rest of the body is thrown off. The rest of the body hurts. We talked last night just a little bit about what's the most important part of your car. And we could debate automotive theory all day. But if you get in a pop-up thunderstorm and you're driving down the interstate and you don't have a little piece of rubber that does this, you can't drive your car. Every part of your car has a function, and when it doesn't work, your car doesn't work right. It puts you at danger. Everybody in this room has a function. If you go, well, I'm not an elder, I quit. Well, they won't let me lead singing. I quit. I can't be they won't let me. And if we look at our job and we say, you know, I don't like my job, so I quit, that's as ridiculous as if your hand quit or your foot quit or your eye quit or something else quit on you. Paul says in a body situation, one body member can't say, I don't like my job, I quit. Now, from that negative scenario, we come up with a positive statement. As a member of the body, I must accept my responsibility. There's something I'm supposed to do. I've got a job to do, and I'm supposed to do it. When we put that to our kids, it teaches them I'm capable, I'm significant, I can influence what happens to me. When we do that among ourselves, it teaches us that we have ownership and responsibility, and we have a buy-in to the unity of the church. Second ridiculous situation that can't happen in a body. Verse 17, if the whole body were an eye, where would be the hearing? If the whole body were hearing, where would be the smelling? But now God has set the members, each one of them in the body, just as He pleased. And if they were all one member, where would the body be? But now indeed there are many members, yet one body. Second ridiculous situation, Paul says, is you can't have a body that is just one thing. If you were a body and you just had an eye, you wouldn't be a body, you'd be a monster. Now, if your body, if we were just one eye, then we could really say to those teenage girls, don't roll that eye at me, but that's the only function that would have. But if we were just a hand or just a mouth or just an eye or just an ear, we wouldn't be a body. We'd be a monster. And Paul says, you can't have everybody look the same. And by the way, one of the ways to measure the health of a church is look at the diversity of the church. Because if we're all the same socioeconomic background and we're all the same political party and we're all the same race, sometimes that looks a lot like a social club and not like a body. Got to be real careful that we don't create people in our own image. We're supposed to bring people to be like Christ, not to be like us. And we're supposed to look like people who can become like Christ and not necessarily bring people in that fit well with us. They fit well with Christ. And I'm afraid sometimes we recruit people to the church because we think the church needs them rather than they need the church. We have diversity in the body. We have different roles. We have different backgrounds. We have different functions. When we moved to Huntsville, Alabama in 1986, I think I was 21, might have been 22. Jackie was 18 or 19. We moved into this large city and we were worshiping at Memorial Parkway Church of Christ. I'd taken the job as their full-time youth minister. And one Sunday after church, this couple said, we'd like to take you to our home for dinner. I thought, well, that's going to be a long afternoon because where I grew up, you ate dinner at dark. They meant lunch, but anyway, there's a cultural difference. So we go to this people's home. It's the home of Gary and Mary Chun. Gary was the executive vice president for Chrysler. And Chrysler closed their plant and moved away, and now Remington has built the factory in the old Chrysler plant. But we drive over to the Chun's house, and my dad worked at a dairy. My mom didn't work till we were in middle school. Jackie's dad was a construction painter and traveled all over the country. So I'm not a very cultured person. I'm not a very sophisticated person. And we walk into this house, and it's one of the biggest houses I'd ever seen, let alone one of the biggest houses I've ever been in. And Sister Chun announces, we're going to have dinner in the formal dining room. I didn't know what a formal dining room was. We had two rooms you could eat at our house. You had the room that had the table, and you had the room that had the TV. If you ate in front of the black and white TV, you ate on a TV tray. I'd never been in a formal dining room. We walked around the corner, and here's this separate room with this big mahogany table and all this stuff. They were fat forks and skinny forks and long spoons and short spoons and sharp knives and dull knives and serrated knives and butter knives and glasses and cups and stems and saucers. I thought, are we going to eat? Are we going to fight? There's enough hardware on this table, I could take over a small third world country. And I'm nervous. I sit down at this table, and you can tell. You know, Jackie leans over and says, you will not embarrass me. I leaned over and whispered to her, what do you think I'm supposed to do? She said, you eat what Miss Chun eats with what Miss Chun eats it with. I said, what if I don't like it? She said, rule number one, you will not embarrass me. So I paid real close attention to Sister Chun, and it's really not that sophisticated of a process. You start on the outside, work to the inside, and we survived. Why in the world do you put that much stuff on a table? You ever tried to eat soup with a fork? A little boy in the fellowship hall tried it yesterday. Somebody came by and said, son, why don't you get a spoon? That worked out real good for him. Did you ever try to eat a good steak with a spoon? They talked about a guy in Arkansas that he put honey on his peas. And they said, why do you put honey on your peas? He said, it doesn't taste very good, but it keeps them on my knife. Well, there's ultimate problems across the system. You have different stuff on a table because that stuff has different jobs. And you can't do what I can do, and I can't do what you can do. But God has set us just as it pleased Him. He's arranged this body like a beautiful table setting and given us a function. And some of us are Tupperware glasses that we feed the company, and some of us are stemware, and some of us are salad forks, and some of us are teaspoons and tablespoons. And God said, I need you here to make my table complete. And without us, it wouldn't be complete. And we shouldn't all try to be the same thing. We shouldn't all try to be alike each other. Because if we just had that one look, we wouldn't have the diversity of the body. We'd be a monster. Rule number one, then, is accept your responsibility. Rule number two is accept your limitations. And let me add to that, that we get so wrapped up about what we are not that we fail to understand and celebrate and capitalize on what we are. I do some adventure-based therapy without chasing a rabbit very far. I got started taking kids rock climbing and rappelling to teach them some things about making good choices, about trust, and about anchor points in their lives. It's a big parable, and I would take one or two kids with me. There's some property that the city of Huntsville owns called Three Caves. It's this big canyon, and it has three caves. Genius again. And if Taylor watch him where you're eating, hang his head. So I would get a permit to take these kids rappelling over in the Three Caves area. Well, the city of Huntsville decided, the city of Huntsville Youth and Recreation Services decided they'd like to do some outward bound type programs for inner city kids. They contacted the land trust. Hey, could we use the Three Caves area to do some programming with kids? And do you guys offer any programming like that? They said, we don't, but we know a guy that might. So I got contacted by Youth and Recreation Services about taking inner city kids and doing some adventure-based stuff with them. A couple of rules when you do adventure-based stuff. Nobody writes newspaper articles about the 20 kids you bring back. It's that one kid you leave out there gets you in the paper. So I was a little uncomfortable taking kids out on a rock site. And I just simply said, if you'll build me an indoor climbing wall at one of the community centers, I'll donate time to it. I drew up some plans, and they built me a wall. We used the old Lakewood Community Center. Started in 92 and probably went to 2004. We donated after-school programs with kids, teaching them to climb and using the rock climbing wall and a little beam we would rappel off of as a teaching tool. One of the things that we taught the kids was how to belay each other. Now, amateur rock climbers do a thing called top roping. If you could expose one of these rafters in your building and throw a rope over it, I tie that rope to the climber, I run that rope to a friction brake on my harness, and as you go up, I pull the rope down, pull the slack through the brake, and it creates a top rope situation. As you get closer to the ceiling, your rope gets shorter. And that way, if you fall, you just swing in place. There's no dynamic falls. There's no chance of injury. And that's called top roping or slingshot climbing. All amateur climbers do it. So we rigged this gym with some top rope routes, and we taught the children to belay, that system of pulling the rope. After you've been in the class for a while and you learn to belay, you have to belay other students. And then on the fourth session, you have to belay your mom or your dad. That gets very exciting. Makes a pretty good teaching tool, because you've got this little seventh grade kid who's got his dad up in the air and he's screaming at his dad. You get him on the ground and say, what was up with the screaming? He goes, well, there was a foothold right there and he wouldn't listen to me and I was afraid. Welcome to parenthood. You were in charge of your dad's safety and success for 37 seconds and you like to lost your mind. He's felt that way since you took your first breath. If he gets a little psychotic when you learn to drive or play t-ball, calm down. Now you know the response. And it's a big deal to learn to rappel. Well, in the middle 90s, they sent a kid through we did a seventh grade program called Science and PE. We did it after school. Well, they sent me this group of kids, and one of the little kids in the group only had one arm. A little African-American kid named Chris. And I'll never forget this kid. We arranged, you could change the rock formations and make it kind of like a ladder. So we fixed it where Chris could climb some stuff. And so we're doing the belay thing. I've got ropes hanging, and you've got a bucket of water you have to raise to the ceiling and lower without spilling it to learn the rhythm of belaying. And we're teaching them all this. I got ropes hanging and kids everywhere, and somebody tugs on my harness. Mr. Lonnie, I need to learn to belay, because I haven't given everybody their belay certificates. I look over my shoulder, and it's the one-armed kid, Chris. Mr. Lonnie, I need to learn to belay. And being stupid on Thursdays, I said, Chris, normally you use two hands to belay. And Chris said, well, normally I just have one. The little guy in the seventh grade, about my height, looked me dead in the eye and said, don't tell me what people with two hands can do. Tell me what I can do with the one hand I've got. Outside of this book, one of the two most significant things ever said to me in my life. A little black kid from Huntsville, Alabama. Don't tell me what people with two hands can do. Tell me what I can do with the one hand I've got. Now, folks, if we'll quit worrying about what everybody else can do and figure out what I can do. Don't tell me what somebody half my age can do. What can I do with my age and wisdom and my experience? Don't tell me what somebody three times my age can do. What can I do with my youth and my energy and my strength? Don't tell me what a church can do with 1,000 members. What can we do with these folks? Don't tell me what a church with 4 Trailways buses can do. What can we do with 2 18-passenger vans? Don't tell me what, if we just quit worrying about what everybody else can do and figure out what we can do. Josh Medcalf calls it control the controllables. And when I quit worrying about what I'm not and just figure out what I am, I define where God has set me on the table and what I can do. So rule number one, accept your responsibility. Rule number two, accept your limitations. And then rule number three, the third ridiculous situation that can't take place. Verse 20 again. But now indeed there are many members, yet one body, and the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you. Nor again the head to the feet, I have no need of you. No, much rather those members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary, and those members of the body that we think are less honorable, on these we bestow greater honor. And our unpresentable parts have greater modesty. But our presentable parts have no need, but God composed the body, having given greater honor to the parts which lacks it, that there should be no schism, no division in the body, but that the members should have the same care one for another. And if one member suffers, they all suffer with it. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Third ridiculous situation can't take place in the body. Body can't say, I don't like my job, I quit. Body can't say, hey, let's all be the same. And one body member can't look at another body member and say, we don't need you. Accept your responsibility, accept your limitations, and accept others. Attention, belonging, and support. When one member is honored, we all rejoice with it. When one member suffers, we all minister to it. We suffer with it. After I leave, you want to take a test? John, just get up one Sunday morning and say, everybody get out an attendance card. Write down these three words, attention, belonging, and support. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the worst, 10 being the best, how much attention do you get from this group? Give us a number. How much belonging do you get from this group? Give us a number. How much support do you get from this group? Add up how many people you have here. Do the numbers. Divide it. You get a grade. You'll have an A, B, or a C, I hope. It's just a simple mathematical how much attention, belonging, and support do people perceive that they get from this group? Now, to be honest, come back 2 weeks later. So everybody got a visitor's card. Write down these three words, attention, belonging, and support. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the worst, 10 being the best, how much attention do you give other people? How much belonging do you provide for other people? How much support do you give? And be honest. And you'll find out that a lot of the folks who don't believe they get it don't give it either. And if you feel like there's a disparity between how much attention, belonging, and support you get versus how much you give, then you've got some room to change. We get so wrapped up sometimes in belonging. And sometimes it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. We leave right after the last amen is said, and we only show up right after the services start, and then we don't feel connected to folks, and we don't attend things, and we don't reach out to people. You know, if you just get your church directory and decide, I'm going to go from front to back, and this year contact everybody in it in some way, you might be surprised how much attention, belonging, and support you get. We must accept our responsibility. We must accept our limitations, and we must accept others. And sometimes in accepting others, you've got to view the world from their perspective. And it's very hard to do sometimes. Several years ago, we were cross-training with the canine unit. And they had this idea, instead of sending a SWAT team into a building to clear the whole building, could we send a dog in the building and find the one or two rooms that were occupied? And then the SWAT team doesn't have to go in and clear the whole thing. We just go up to the room that the dog's standing at and get the guy out. And maybe even get the dog to get the guy out. And so they said, hey, let's try that out. Lonnie, go hide in the building. So they put me in the Michelin Man suit. And I went into the old Farley school building and they released a land shark on me. Now, I'd never been in this building and the dog had never been in the building. It's a very intimidating thing to be standing in the building in pitch black dark and hear nothing. And then all of a sudden, something grabbed you in the dark. Okay, that dog hit me, grabbed my arm, pulled me down. I weigh into 180 to 190, depending on what gravity's doing that day. And that dog drugged me out of that building into the waiting arms of his handler. They said, that worked pretty good. Let's try it again. So, but this time, let's see how the dog behaves on the retrieval if the SWAT guys are in the building. So the SWAT guys geared up. They open the trunks of their cars. They put their knee pads on. They put their Ninja Turtle vest on. They put their ninja hoods on. They put their helmets on. They put their gloves on. They put their shoulder pads on. And when they came around the corner, the dog's name is Dakota. Dakota hates me. I hate Dakota. It's mutual. Dakota lays in the back of his car, and when I go by his window, he lunges at me. And I always get on top of the other car. He knows who I am, and he likes to frighten me. But when the SWAT guys came around the building in their body armor, Dakota lost his mind. He went crazy. It looked like you'd taken a cattle prod and zapped the Tasmanian devil. He was slobbering and barking and lunging. And his handler is Tim Gann. Tim's a district attorney now. But his handler then was Tim Gann. And Dakota's just lunging. And Tim said, I don't know what's wrong with my dog. I said, Tim, look at the way I'm dressed. I'm still in the Michelin Man suit. And look at the way these guys are dressed. He can't differentiate between body armor and bite suit. He thinks everybody's playing now. He said, I got targets to chew on all day. And what the SWAT guys were wearing as protection, the dog saw as a sign to attack. And sometimes I have to do some things to feel comfortable in a crowd. And you see it as a sign to attack. I may need to dress a certain way to be comfortable. I may need to sit closer to the back to be okay. I've got a client who was a tunnel rat in Vietnam. He does good to be in the building, much less near the front of the building. I've treated him for post-traumatic stress for years. But when he comes into a public assembly, he likes to have a wall against his back. And don't walk up behind him and grab him either, okay? But what happens is that sometimes the very thing, and I'm doing the best I can, you don't like it, or you're not comfortable with it, or you're not used to it, and you see it as a sign of attack. Folks, when we begin to understand that people are allowed to be different, and we've got to get past some of those differences, it's easy for us to accept our responsibility, accept our limitations, and accept others. And then the closest Paul's going to get to using the word corporate individuality, he does in this next verse. Look at verse 26. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Now you are the body of Christ, but members individually. Corporate individuality. You are the body, but there are individual members. And if we simply changed our self-identity, if I viewed myself as a body member and therefore viewed you as a body member, our relationship wouldn't come as to whether we're Jews or Greeks or slave or free. Our relationship would come because we're connected to Christ. And if I see you as connected to Christ and I'm connected to Christ, we're connected to each other. And then our definitions of each other don't have to be about young or old or rich or poor or fast or slow or thick or thin or anything. It's you're connected to Christ, so you're connected to me. Jackie and I got married, like I said, when I was like 21 and she was 18. My mom and dad just sort of adopted a new teenage girl. Jackie and I, my brother is 18 months older than me, and he wasn't married and didn't get married till he was 39. So we had lots of Christmases and lots of Thanksgivings and lots of vacations where Dad and Mom and me and Jackie and my brother were there. I'm living in Huntsville doing my thing. He's living in Montgomery, and all of a sudden this name starts showing up on some of his emails. And he's got this girl named Missy, and Missy keeps showing up, and she even shows up at Thanksgiving. And then all of a sudden we feel like, hey, Missy's going to be a permanent part of our lives, and Gerald gets married to Missy. Now, it's been me and Jackie and Gerald and Mom and Dad for ages, and now Missy, and we didn't grow up getting to run around with Missy. Missy's just this person my brother knows, and now I've got a sister-in-law named Missy. Jackie grew up in Velvet Ridge, Arkansas, knows how to plow behind a mule, rode a dirt bike, swam in the creek. Missy doesn't like to sweat. her idea of roughing it is a Holiday Inn without a pool, okay? She doesn't like a lot of adventure, doesn't like to be outside much, and really, really different. When Gerald and Missy got married, they were standing on the podium, and it had one of those big air vents. And I'm on the podium, and we're there, and somebody says, "Are there rings present?" Well, I thought it'd be funny if somebody dropped a penny down that air vent and sounded like a ring went through there. And Missy didn't think it was funny. I'll tell you that right now. And so, you know, get past our humor. Well, they get married, and now they're going to have children. And their friends who were having children, they went through that thing where you name your children after, you know, antique furniture, like Armoire Chippendale and those weird kind of names like that. Well, as a good uncle, I thought, hey, if you have a little girl, you can name her Enya. Her middle name could be Anna. So she'd be Inyana Jones. I thought that rocked. Missy was not really impressed with my choices of a niece name. And over the years, we've had to get used to that. And let me just say, Missy is a gracious person. She's a lovely lady. Absolutely dotes on my parents and absolutely doted on Lonnie Beth while she was little when Missy first came into our family. And I love her dearly. But if my personal opinion of her was different, would it matter? Because she's married to my brother. And because she is connected to my brother, she is connected to me. And my phone rings and it's Missy and says, "I need you." Then when I get off the plane in Huntsville, I drive to Montgomery. And she has access to our wealth, and she has access to our time, and she has access to our talents. And I don't want to be that guy, but I would kill for her or die for her simply because she is my brother's wife. And because she's connected to Gerald, she is connected to me. And because you are connected to Christ, you are connected to me. And because you're connected to Christ, you're connected to me. And there's nothing about slave, free, Jew, Greek, white, black, green, purple, yellow, orange, young, old, or anything else that should matter, because we are connected to one another. Occasionally in my job, I go out of town and do things for corporations. And Jackie say, "Where are you going this weekend?" "Well, I'm going to do this thing in Cookeville for Tutco. I'm going to go to Cookeville and do a thing at Tennessee Tech." And she'll say, "Who's your point of contact? Where are you staying? What's the phone number I can reach at?" She gets in my business somewhat. "Where are you going this weekend?" "I'm going to Missouri." "Is it a church thing?" "Yeah, you'll be okay." Because she knows that when I'm with the church people, we're connected. We're family. She doesn't have to worry about if I get in an accident or get hurt or get sick. If I'm with the brethren, I'll be cared for. And they'd probably go so far as to fly her up here to be with me if something happened and I were hospitalized. And she doesn't worry about it when I'm with you. And that's with you in Georgia or Mississippi or Alabama or California or Ohio. When I'm traveling with the church, she knows we're connected. Because the place I'm going is connected to Christ, and we're connected to Christ. You are the member of Christ, but members individually. Accept your responsibility, accept your limitations, and accept one another. And if we ever define ourselves not by these labels of age or anything else, but just that we're body members, then we change the dynamic of who we are and how we conduct business. I'm going to run through this last section really fast, but I want you to understand that Paul's going to ask a series of rhetorical questions. Rhetorical questions don't beg an answer, but we're going to answer that and then just move right through his conclusion. Now, you are the body of Christ and members individually, and God has appointed these in the church, first to apostles and second prophets and third teachers, and after that miracles and then gifts of healings and helps and administration and a variety of tongues. Are all apostles? Well, no. Are all prophets? Absolutely not. Are all teachers? No. Are all workers of miracles? No. Do all have gifts of healings? No. Do all speak with tongues? No. Do all interpret? No. But earnestly desire the best gifts. And yet I show you a more excellent way. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I'm a sounding brass or clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith that I can remove mountains and have not love, I'm nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not love, it profits me nothing. See, Paul says there's all these kind of gifts, and everybody can't do everything, and some of you can't even do any of that stuff. But it doesn't really matter what you do. See, it doesn't matter if you're eloquent and could speak like an angel. If you deliver those speeches and it wasn't because you love these people, then it doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter how smart you are and if you understood all mysteries. If you used your smarts and your motivation wasn't love for these people, it doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter if you're rich and philanthropic to the point that you donate your body to be burned. If you made that sacrifice and it's not because you love these people, then it doesn't matter. And of all the things we've talked about and all the things we've mentioned about intergenerational ministry and individual roles and the things that we can do or the things we can't do, I don't know what your specific job is, but the one job you have is to love people. And if you can love people, you can be a part of the body. And if you can love people, you can be functional. And it really doesn't matter what your specific job is, as long as when you come to do that job, you do it because you view yourself as, I'm connected to these people are connected to Christ, and I love them whether or not I think they love me. Because love is an attitude, not an emotion. And when we get that into our minds, then I'll accept my responsibility. I'll accept my limitations, and I'll accept others. Let me ask you those same two questions I've asked all weekend. Number one, are you a member of the body? If you're not a baptized believer, if you've not been baptized, you've not been baptized into the body, then you're not a member of the body. And if you're not a member of the body, you're not a member of the church. If you're not a member of the church, you're still guilty of your sins, and you have a sin problem that Jesus died to take care of. Please don't leave today without being baptized to take care of those sins. Question number two, if you have been baptized and you are a member of the body, are you a healthy, functioning member of the body? Do you accept your responsibility? Have you accepted your limitations? And do you do your best to accept others? And if that's not your attitude and that's not your action, then we ask you to change it publicly or privately. If we could help you in a public way, come down this aisle while we stand, while we sing.